Edith Cavell by Lawrence Binyon. She was binding the wounds of her enemies when they came, the lint in her hand unrolled. They battered the door with their rifle butts, crashed it in. She faced them, gentle and bold. They held her before the judges where they sat, in their places, helmet on head. With question and menace the judges assailed her. "Yes, I have broken your law," she said. "I have tended the hurt and hidden the hunted, have done as a sister does to a brother, because of a law that is greater than that you have made, because I could do none other. Deal as you will with me, this is my choice to the end, to live in the life I vowed." "She is self-confessed," they cried, "she is self-condemned. She shall die, that the rest may be cowed." In the terrible hour of the dawn, when the veins are cold, they led her forth to the wall. "I have loved my land," she said, "but it is not enough. Love requires of me all. I will empty my heart of the bitterness, hating none." And sweetness filled her brave with a vision of understanding beyond the hour that knelled to the waiting grave. They bound her eyes, but she stood as if she shone. The rifles it was that shook when the hoarse command rang out. They could not endure that last, that defenseless look. And the officer strode and pistoled her surely, ashamed that men, seasoned in blood, should quail at a woman, only a woman, dead, as a flower stamped in the mud. And now that the deed was securely done, in the night when none had known her fate, they answered those that had striven for her, day by day, "It is over, you come too late." And with many words and sorrowful phrased excuse, argued their German right to kill, most legally, hard though the duty may be, the law must assert its might. Only a woman, yet she had pity on them. The victim offered slain to the gods of fear that they worship. Leave them there, red hands to clutch their game. She bewailed not herself, and we will bewail her not, but with tears of pride rejoice that an English soul was found so crystal clear to be triumphant voice. Of the human heart that dares adventure all, but live to itself untrue, and beyond all laws sees love as the light in the night, as the star it must answer to. The hurts she healed, the thousands comforted, these make a fragrance of her fame. But because she stepped to her star right on through death, it is victory speaks her name.
Lawrence Binyon is most famous for his poem For the Fallen, always read on important occasions and in particular on Remembrance Sunday. But in this poem, he's talking about the execution of the Norfolk nurse Edith Cavell, who aided Allied soldiers during World War I. That poem portrays her courageous and compassionate nature, and it showed her unwavering in her moral principles, despite the fact that she was facing certain death. A few weeks ago, I was walking through the North Norfolk holiday village of Mundersley, and I had in my hand a postcard that Edith had sent to her mother. She wrote on the postcard that Mundersley was much changed, and it was a place that Edith and her mum visited on holiday many times before she went off to serve as a nurse in Brussels, way behind the German lines, prior and during World War I. And it is to Edith that this week's podcast with me, Terry Wenham, Tales from the Battlefields, is devoted. Most of the stories that we talk about are about the men that died in the trenches or in no man's land during the Great War. But we mustn't forget the sacrifice that so many women gave, and none more so than this incredible lady who was 49 years old when she died in front of a firing squad in October of 1915. It is now over 110 years since Edith died, so what I decided to do was to follow her footsteps around her home in Norfolk. And to do this, I started off in the village of Swarston. I visited St Mary's Church there, knowing that there was a window dedicated to her, and I'd also heard that there was some archives there that I was hoping to see. Now, with the majority of churches in rural areas like Norfolk, they're left open so the public can have access at any time, and I kept my fingers crossed that that would be the case when I arrived there. But then, as quite often happens when we're looking at the stories from the Great War, there was an incredible coincidence. Because as I got out the car in front of the church and gazed at the war memorial, I was approached by a man called Nick Miller. And incredibly, Nick was walking home from a Pilates class, and he saw me looking at the war memorial, and he came over and introduced himself. And it turns out he was the archivist for the church, and he'd spent many decades investigating the story of Edith. And he offered to give me a guided tour of the church and tell her story, but not just her story, but the story of her parents. So who was her father? The Reverend Frederick Cavell came to the village soon after he was ordained. And he liked it so much here that he stayed for 46 years. In 1865, Edith Louisa Cavell was born. And as we'll find out, she's still there in so many ways. Her father, Frederick, he paid for the local vicarage to be built, and it affected him financially, the local state. It nearly ruined him. But even if the family were poor and they were concerned to share what they had with their poorer parishioners, Sunday lunch was a great family affair. And whatever was cut from the Sunday joint, an equal amount was taken out to the hungry cottages nearby. Sundays in the Victorian vicarage could be gloomy by today's standards. There were no cards, no books allowed except the Bible. Frederick was something of a Puritan, and he wanted to keep a strict Sabbath. And Edith wrote to her favourite cousin, his name was Eddie. She said, "Do come and stay again soon, but not for a weekend. Father's sermons are so long and dull." One of Edith's favourite winter pastimes was ice skating. The moat at the old rectory behind the church would often freeze in winter, and this was a favourite haunt of Edith and her two siblings. Edith had a great respect and love of nature, and she seems to have always surrounded herself with plants and animals. Now we can see what a spirit Edith had even when she was a young girl. And it's said that she knew that her father badly needed a church room to house the growing Sunday school for the children of the village, and she was determined to do something about it. So she wrote to the Bishop of Norwich. She told him of the problem, and he agreed to help, provided the village would raise some of the cash. So Edith being Edith, within a very short time, her and her sister were making good use of her artistic talents. And she'd painted cards, which were then sold, and she helped to raise £300 for the church room. Edith wrote to the bishop, reminding him of his promise, and so the church room was built adjoining the vicarage, and apparently it was very well used. Both Mrs. Cavell and Edith herself taught in the Sunday school and acted as godmothers to a number of local babies. Sadly, this church room was sold when the vicarage was sold, and once again the parish was without its church room. But in recent years, a new church room has been provided in the churchyard adjacent to the church, and it's known as the Cavell Room in honour of Edith. Before she became a nurse, she had several jobs as a governess. Her first job was to look after the clergy household in a village, another village in Norfolk. And despite the demands of that job, she found time to keep up her hobbies, mainly tennis and dancing. Once, apparently, she danced until her feet bled and it ruined her new shoes. Locals said that she's remembered as being full of fun, always smiling and wonderfully kind to the children that she was in charge of. About this time, Edith was left a small legacy in someone's will, and she decided to spend it on a European holiday. She spent some weeks in Austria and Bavaria in southern Germany. And she was deeply impressed with a free hospital that was being run by a Dr. Wolfenberg. And it's said that that's what inspired her growing interest in nursing. In 1890, she took up a post with a family in Brussels, and she stayed there for 5 years and became a firm favourite with the family. She continued to paint in her spare time, and she became fluent in French. During the summer, she came back to Swarston, playing tennis and painting, and I mentioned Eddie, her cousin, a few minutes ago, and she became romantically attached to him. He was her second cousin. It appears that they were very much in love, and Edith never forgot him, and she even wrote a message to him on the day of her execution. In 1895, Edith returned to Swarston to nurse her father through an illness, and that's when she made up her mind to become a nurse. By 1898, she'd completed her training and she was able to deal with cases of pleurisy, pneumonia, typhoid. She moved down to London and was a night superintendent at a hospital in St Pancras. Worked in a poor law institution, what we commonly know as a workhouse. She moved to Shoreditch and she became assistant matron in 1903. Now in 1907, Edith returned to Brussels to nurse a child patient of a man called Dr. Depage. Now, he wanted to pioneer the training of nurses in Belgium along the lines of Florence Nightingale. Until now, nuns had been responsible for the care of the sick. But of course, they weren't trained to do this. Edith was now in her early 40s and she was put in charge of a pioneer training school. And this was on the outskirts of Brussels, the capital city of Belgium. She thrived on this responsibility. She was known to have a poor record for punctuality, but she kept a watch before her breakfast, and any unfortunate woman who was more than 2 minutes late would forfeit 2 hours of her spare time. Edith wrote home. She said the old idea that it is a disgrace for women to work is still held in Belgium, and women of good birth and education still think they lose respect by earning their own living. However, when the Queen of the Belgians broke her arm and sent to the school for a trained nurse, suddenly the status of this school was assured and respected. By 1912, Edith was providing nurses for 3 hospitals, 24 communal schools and 13 kindergartens. And by 1914, she was giving 4 lectures a week to doctors and nurses. Her father died in 1910, and Edith would often return to Norfolk to visit her mum. And that's when they went to Mundersley and other places on the North Norfolk coast for holidays. And back home in Swarston, Edith was weeding her mother's garden when she heard the news of the German invasion of Belgium. They tried to persuade her to stay at home in England. She was having none of it. She said, at a time like this, I'm needed more than ever. And by the 3rd of August 1914, the day before the war began, she was back in Brussels, dispatching the Dutch and German nurses home and impressing on the others that their first duty was to care for the wounded, irrespective of nationality. Their clinic became a Red Cross hospital, German soldiers receiving the same attention as the Belgians. And when Brussels fell, the Germans commandeered the Royal Palace for their own wounded and 60 English nurses were sent home. But Edith and her assistant, Miss Wilkins, they remained. So now she was cut off because of the British retreat from Mons and the French being driven back. And in the autumn of 1914, two stranded British soldiers found their way to her training school and they were sheltered there for 2 weeks. Others followed. All of them were spirited away to neutral territory in Holland. One of them was from the 1st Battalion of the Norfolk Regiment. She was delighted to receive someone from her beloved Norfolk, and she asked this private, who was called Arthur Wood, to take home her Bible and a letter for her mother. Very quickly, more and more Allied soldiers were helped to escape. This passage lasted for almost a year, and Edith must have known the risks involved. It is said that a Belgian collaborator gave Edith away and told the Germans of her secret. The school was searched while a soldier slipped out through the back garden. Edith remained calm. She'd sewn her diary up inside a cushion and didn't find any incriminating papers. But Edith was arrested anyway and interned. She was then interrogated and she was told that other prisoners had confessed. Being a bit naive, I suppose, she believed them and she revealed everything. It's said that she trusted her captors. She was only too pleased to tell them the truth. Without realising, she'd condemned herself. Edith and four others were sentenced to death. The Germans were determined to carry out the executions immediately. Now, news of the execution was soon picked up by the local embassies in Brussels. America at this stage was neutral. And their ambassador, a man called Brand Whitlock, made representations to the Germans to try and get them to change their mind. The Western Front Association, on their website, have transcribed what Brand wrote about his efforts to get her reprieved. And I'm going to play the transcription for you now. There are hundreds of these recordings on the Western Front Association website, which is available for anyone to view. I do recommend you go and have a look at that if you get a chance. But in the meantime, this is what Brand said.
A famous American diplomat tells of the dramatic last appeals for mercy made to the Germans on behalf of that brave nurse, Edith Cavell, accused of smuggling British and Belgian soldiers across the frontier, who was to be shot less than 12 hours after she was condemned. As is known, these pleas were ignored, and a crime was committed which sent a wave of horror throughout the English-speaking peoples. Miss Cavell's last thoughts were embodied in the famous words, "Patriotism is not enough." Though lying on a sickbed, Mr. Whitlock left no stone unturned to save Nurse Cavell. And where the representative of the greatest neutral power failed, no one could have succeeded. At 9 o'clock that Monday evening, October 11, 1915, Maître de Laval, a lawyer friend of the author, appeared suddenly at the door of my chamber. His face was deathly pallid. He said that he had just heard from the nurses who were keeping him informed that the judgment had been confirmed and that the sentence of death had been pronounced on Miss Cavell at 4:30 that afternoon, and that she was to be shot at 2 o'clock the next morning. It seemed impossible, especially the immediate execution of sentence. There had always been time at least to prepare and to present a plea for mercy. To condemn a woman in the evening and then to hurry her out to be shot before another dawn, preposterous. But no, Maître de Laval was certain. That evening he had gone home and was writing at his table when, about 8 o'clock, two nurses were introduced. One was Miss Wilkerson, small and nervous, all in tears. The other, bigger and quieter. Miss Wilkinson said that she had just learned that the court had condemned Miss Cavell to death, that the judgment had been read to her in the cell of the prison at 4:30 that afternoon, and that the Germans were going to shoot her that night at 2 o'clock. Maître de Laval told her that it was difficult to believe such news, since twice he had been told that the judgment had not been rendered and would not be rendered before the following day. But on her reiterating that she had this news from a source that was indisputable, de Laval left at once with her and her friend to the legation. And there he stood, pale and shaken. Even then, I could not believe it. It was too preposterous. Surely a stay of execution would be granted. Already in the afternoon, in some premonition, Maître de Laval had prepared for my signature an appeal for pardon to be submitted to the Governor General and a letter of transmittal to present to the Baron von der Lancken. I asked Maître de Laval to bring me these documents and signed them. Then, at the last minute, on the letter addressed to von der Lancken, head of the German political section in Brussels, I wrote these words. My dear Baron, I am too ill to present my request to you myself, but I appeal to your generosity to support it and save this unfortunate woman from her death. Have pity on her. Yours faithfully, Brand Whitlock. I told Maître de Laval to send Joseph at once to hunt up Gibson, the secretary of the U.S. legation, to present the plea, and if possible, to find the Marquis Villalobar, the Spanish minister, and to ask him to support it with the Baron von der Lancken. The governor general was in his chateau at Trois-Fontaines, 10 miles away, playing bridge that evening. Maître de Laval went. The nurses from Miss Cavell's school were waiting in a lower room. Other nurses came for news. They, too, had heard, but could not believe. Then the Reverend Maître Gahan, pastor of the English church, came. He had had a note from someone at St. Giles Prison, a note written in German saying simply, "Come at once, someone is about to die." He went away to the prison. His frail, delicate little wife remained at the legation, and there my wife and Miss Larner sat with those women all that long evening, trying to comfort, to reassure them. Outside, a cold rain was falling. Up in my chamber, I waited. A stay of execution would be granted, of course. They always were granted. There was not in our time anywhere a court, even a German court-martial, that would condemn a woman to death at 4:30 in the afternoon and hurry her out and shoot her before dawn. Midnight came, and Gibson with a dark face and de Laval paler than ever. There was nothing to be done. De Laval had gone to Gibson, and together they went in search of the Marquis, whom they found at Baron Lambert's, a Belgian banker, where he had been dining. He and Baron Lambert and Monsieur Franqui, chairman of the Executive Committee on the National Committee, were over their coffee. The Marquis, Gibson, and de Laval went to the Rue de Lumbermont. The ministry was closed and dark. No one was there. They rang and rang again, and finally the concierge appeared. No one was there, he said. They insisted. The concierge at last found a German functionary, who came down, stood staring stupidly. Everyone was gone. His Excellency was at the theater. At what theater? He did not know. They urged him to go and find out. He disappeared inside, went up and down the stairs 2 or 3 times. Finally, he came out and said that they were at the Le Bois Sacré, the Sacred Wood. They explained that the presence of the Baron was urgent, and they asked the man to go for him. They turned over the motor to him, and he mounted on the box beside Eugenie. They reached the little variety theater there in Rue d'Arnberg. The German functionary went in and found the Baron, who said he would come when the piece was over. All this while, Villalobar, Gibson, and the de Laval were in the salon at the ministry, the room of which I have spoken of so often as the yellow salon because of the satin upholstery of its Louis XVI furniture of white lacquer, that bright, almost laughing little salon, all done in the gayest, lightest tones, where so many little dramas were played. All three of them were deeply moved and very anxious. The eternal contrast, as de Laval said, between the sentiments and things. Lancken entered at last, very much surprised to find them. He was accompanied by Count Harrach and by the young Baron von Falkenhausen. "What is it, gentlemen?" he said. "Has something serious happened?" They told him why they were there, and Lancken, raising his hand, said, "Impossible." He had vaguely heard that afternoon of a condemnation for spying, but he did not know that it is anything to do with the case of Miss Cavell. And in any event, it was impossible that they would put a woman to death that night. "Who has given you this information? For really, to come and disturb me at such an hour, you must have information from serious and trustworthy sources." De Laval replied, "Without doubt, I consider my information trustworthy, but I must refuse to tell you from whom I received it. Besides, what difference does it make? If the information is true, our presence at this hour is justified. If it is not true, I am ready to take the consequence of my mistake." The Baron showed irritation. "What?" he said. "It is because they say that you come and disturb me at such an hour, me and these gentlemen? No, no, gentlemen, this news cannot be true. Orders are never executed with such precipitation, especially when a woman is concerned. Come to see me tomorrow." He paused, then added, "Besides, how can you think that this hour I can obtain any information? The Governor General must certainly be sleeping." Gibson, or one of them, suggested to him that a very simple way of finding out would be to telephone to the prison. "Quite right," he said. "I had not thought of that." He went out, was gone a few minutes, and came back embarrassed, so they said, even a little bit ashamed, for he said, "You are right, gentlemen. I have learned by telephone that Miss Cavell has been condemned and that she will be shot tonight." Then Delaval drew out the letter that I had written to the Baron and gave it to him, and he read it in an undertone, with a little sarcastic smile, so Delaval said. And when he had finished, he handed it back to Delaval and said, "But it is necessary to have a plea for mercy in the same time." "Here it is," said Delaval, and he gave him the document. Then they all sat down. I could see the scene, as it was described to me by Villalobar, by Gibson, by Delaval, in that pretty little salon Louis says that I knew so well. Lonkin giving way to an outburst of feeling against that spy, as he called Miss Cavell, and Gibson and Delaval by turns pleading with him, the Marquis sitting by. It was not a question of spying, as they pointed out. It was a question of the life of a woman, a life that had been devoted to charity, to the service of others. She had nursed wounded soldiers. She had even nursed German wounded at the beginning of the war. And now she was accused of but one thing, of having helped British soldiers make their way towards Holland. She may have been imprudent. She may have acted against the laws of an occupying power, but she was not a spy. She was not even accused of being a spy. She had not been convicted of spying, and she did not merit the death of a spy. They sat there pleading, Gibson and Delaval, bringing forth all the arguments that would occur to men of sense and sensibility. Gibson called Lonkin's attention to their failure to inform the legation of the sentence, of their failure to keep the word that had been given. He argued that the offense charged against Miss Cavell had long since been accomplished, that as she had been for some weeks in prison, a slight delay in carrying out the sentence could not endanger the German cause. He even pointed out the effect that such a deed as the summary execution of a sentence against a woman would have on public opinion, not only in Belgium, but in America and elsewhere. He even spoke of the possibility of reprisals. But it was all in vain. Baron von der Lancken explained to them that the military governor, that is, General von Sauversveg, was the supreme authority in matters of this sort, that the governor general himself had no authority to intervene in such cases, and that under the provisions of German martial law, it lay within the discretion of the military governor to accept or refuse an appeal for clemency. And then Villalobar suddenly cried out, "Oh, come now, it is a woman. You can't shoot a woman like that." The Baron paused, was evidently moved. "Gentlemen, it's past 11 o'clock. What can be done?" It was only von Sauversveg who could act, he said, and they urged the Baron to go see von Sauversveg. Finally, he consented. While he was gone, Villalobar, Gibson, and Delaval repeated to Harrach and von Falkenhausen all the arguments that might move them. Von Falkenhausen was young. He had been to Cambridge in England, and he was touched, though of course he was powerless. And Delaval said that when he gave signs of showing pity, Harrach cast a glance at him, so he said nothing more. And then Harrach said, "The life of one German soldier seems to us much more important than that of all these old English nurses." At last, Lonkin returned and, standing there, announced, "I am exceedingly sorry, but the governor tells me that it is after due reflection that the execution was decided upon, and that he will not change his decision. Making use of his prerogative, he even refuses to receive the plea for mercy. Therefore, no one, not even the emperor, can do anything for you." With this, he handed my letter and the request for clemency to Gibson. There was a moment of silence in the yellow salon. Then Villalobar sprang up and, seizing Lonkin by the shoulder, said to him in an energetic tone, "Baron, I insist on speaking to you." "It's useless," began Lonkin. "I want to talk to you," the Marquis replied, giving categorical emphasis to the harsh imperative. The old Spanish pride had been mounting in the Marquis, and he literally dragged the tall von der Lancken into a little room nearby. Then voices were heard in sharp discussion, and even through the partition, the voice of Villalobar. "It is idiotic, this thing you are going to do. You will have another Louvain." A few moments later, they came back, Villalobar in silent rage, Lancken very red. And, as Delaval said, without another word, dumb, in consternation, filled with despair, they came away. I heard the report, and they withdrew. A little while, and I heard the street door open. The woman who had waited all that night went out into the rain. The rain had ceased, and the air was soft and warm the next morning. The sunlight shone through an autumn haze, but over the city, the horror of the dreadful deed hung like a pall. Bills were early posted, and crowds huddled about them in a kind of stupefaction, reading the long and tragic list down to the line that closed with a piece of gratuitous brutality. The sentence against Balk and Cavell has already been carried out. Of the 26 others condemned, with Miss Cavell, 4, Philip Bach, an architect of Brussels, Louis Tuilez, a schoolteacher of Lille, Louis Savarat, a pharmacist of Brussels, and the Countess Jeanne de Bileville were sentenced to death. All day long, sad and solemn groups stood in the boulevards gazing at the grim poster. In one of the throngs, a dignified old judge said, "It was not the carrying out of a sentence. It was murder."
I don't know about you, but as I listened to that account and of the attempted negotiations that were going on through the governments and high-ranking officials of America, Brussels and Germany, it doesn't seem right, does it, that they were discussing the life of a woman from a quiet village in Norfolk that had spent her entire life helping others. But her fate was out of her hands, and she was about to pay the ultimate price for her kindness. There was an English chaplain who spent that last night with her. His name was Stirling Gahan. And she told him, and these were his words, she said, Edith said, "I'm thankful to have had these 10 weeks of quiet to get ready. Now I have had them and have been very kindly treated here. I expected my sentence and I believe it was just. Standing as I do in view of God and eternity, I realise that patriotism is not enough. I must have no hatred or bitterness towards anyone." Those words are going to crop up again as we follow Edith's journey from her home to her final resting place at Norwich Cathedral. And we're going to start with my visit to Swarston Church, whereas, as I said, it was a sheer coincidence that I was to meet up with Nick, who knew so much about Edith's life in Norfolk. So it's the week before Christmas, a very cold, dull day, and decided to come on the trail of famous World War I nurse Edith Cavell, the brave Christian lady that, it is said, helped 200, at least 200, Allied servicemen, mainly soldiers, from captivity in Brussels back home to Blighty. And this is where our home was. I'm standing outside St Mary the Virgin Church in Edith's home village of Swarston, just about 6 miles from Norwich, county town of Norfolk in the east of England. This is the beginning of her story, and something very unusual is on the war memorial outside of the church. There are 10 names of soldiers, all men, that died from this village in the Great War, but they're listed in two columns, but across the top of those two columns, at the top, it says Pro Patria, Edith Louisa Cavell. And I'm racking my memory, but I can't think of seeing another war memorial in the UK that contains the name of a woman. But there she is, possibly one of the most famous women to have served in World War I and who gave her life for the war effort, Edith Louisa Cavell. About to come in turn. Yep. And would you mind introducing yourself,
sure,
please?
I'm Nick Miller, and I've lived in the village for over 30 years, and I have been following, quotes, Edith Cavell for most of that time.
Have you?
And I'm the archivist for her, for the church, and in conjunction with the cathedral where she's remembered.
Excellent, which is going to be my next stop later on today. So,
great.
I mean, this wasn't planned. We didn't arrange to meet here, did we?
Nope. It's,
when we go onto the battlefields, quite often things happen for a reason when we're over on the Western Front.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've literally just turned up now. You said you're just on your way home after Pilates.
That's right.
I was turning up here hoping and praying that the church would be open, which I understand it is.
Always.
But I understand there's another building as well.
There is a little room.
So, show me around. That's the home there, the red brick building
that's
over
right.
there. So we really are following in the great lady's footsteps, aren't we?
That's an interesting thing you should say, because literally where you're standing, can you see an indentation in the churchyard grass?
Yes, it's like almost like a trench.
Correct. World War One trench, no, not quite. There's a green gate.
I can.
She and her father and the whole family would have come in crocodile fashion along this path, and they made that indentation in the churchyard.
Really?
Over, he was here 46 years.
Her dad was?
Yeah, and there were four children, and there used to be dad in front, and then the four children, and then mother at the back, and the maids, and they'd all come in for Sunday service.
So that really is incredible. We really are looking at a path that Edith and her family have made. It really is genuinely footsteps, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
And through that green gate
through
there.
That gate, and you can see her father's study. He looked out on the church. He built that house. He had it built, obviously. But that is his study window, so he could watch anything that was going on in the church. There wasn't such a big hedge, and he could look across this way. And she's done paintings of the church from that vantage point.
Yes, yes.
She was a very, very good artist.
Yes, I've seen some of her paintings.
And father and mother are buried right there, under that stone over there.
Ah, the Cavell family grave.
That's right, immediately next to the gate.
They couldn't be closer to home then, really, could they?
Absolutely.
So there's a rather impressive stone that tells us the Reverend Frederick Cavell, for 46 years, vicar of this parish, and he's died in 1910, which is a good age, 86.
That's right.
And then also Louisa Sophia, his wife, and she died in 1918, in her 82nd year. So Father Frederick would not have known what happened to his daughter in the First World War, but Mum Louisa did and would have been aware of it.
And she last saw her daughter, not here, but in their home in Norwich, in July 1914. And then Edith corresponded from Brussels to her when she could get a letter out.
Yes.
They had to be very guarded as to what they were saying.
Because she's behind enemy lines, isn't she?
A long way
behind enemy lines.
Absolutely. And the post getting it out through the American embassy and all this, it was quite a palaver.
So we're now walking along the path that you've just pointed out to me, which there is nothing beneath our feet other than wet grass, but we can clearly see where she's walked and where other people have walked as well.
And she would have walked past many of these graves.
She'd have known them,
wouldn't
she?
May have known some of the people therein.
Of course.
Yeah.
And tell me about the village. Is it a very big village? I've not been here
before. No, it was about 200-ish in her day.
Yeah.
So it was quite amazing to have a full-time vicar for 200 people.
Yes.
But it was big enough to have a school for, in those days, 50 children, and then, you know, primary school up to 12. That's where I happen to live.
In the old school building?
Exactly.
Right.
So the church is roughly, the main nave is 1350.
Yeah,
easiest to say this. 1350, 1450 for the huge tower added on, and then a Tudor porch so that the vicar didn't get wet. 1550.
And it's a typical Norfolk tower, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Lots of flint and local materials, and it's lead roof, and then you've got some tiles on the Tudor porch.
Another wonderful thick oak. Was this be made of oak?
Definitely. Yeah, and solid. Heavy too.
It is heavy, isn't it?
Don't think about the layout here now.
Right.
I'll show you a picture, however, somewhere over here. There, up on the wall. How it was in her time, more or less, we think. But these pews came in after the Second World War, when the church has been closed in Norwich.
I mean, what I noticed as well outside, as you mentioned, the Second World War Memorial is brand new.
Mm-hmm.
The First World War Memorial had about 10, 12 names on it, like that. But here on the left, you don't always see this in churches, is a roll of honour. And it lists all the people from such a small village, because you said there was only 200-odd people
That's right.
that lived here.
It is said that every man of military age, by the time they'd heard her story and were able to be freed from the things they had to do, they signed up.
I mean, they did use her story as propaganda to try and get people to sign up.
Yep.
But there are some wonderful names on there as well, aren't there, from local people? And there must be, as I say, there must be 50, 60 names on there at least.
57
names are there.
Of whom 10 died.
10 died. Right.
Edith is not on there because she didn't serve as a soldier.
No, but she's on the war memorial.
She is on the war memorial, which is unheard of, is to have a woman on a war memorial.
That's the first thing I noticed when I pulled up.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know what I was going to find here today, and that was the first thing I noticed was her name
there. I'll show you the other thing that you will almost certainly, I'm prepared to be challenged. I'd love to hear from somebody who can say, no, you're not the only one, but you will never anywhere else see a nurse with a Red Cross armband in the east window, which was entirely given by the local village to commemorate her.
And there we can see her at the bottom there.
That's right. Under the figure of Jesus on the cross is somebody who also knew martyrdom.
Yes.
In a sense.
Of course. And there she is with the Red Cross on her left sleeve.
Yeah.
And looks like she's in prayer there as well.
She's exactly that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the little plaque up on the right says all the materials and costs of this were met by people in the village, and all the workmen who did any work on the glass or the stained glass or on anything else, all gave their time and their efforts free.
That's fantastic.
So this is much as she would have known it today. The church has hardly changed apart from the pews being new.
And it's small. It seems small compared to the outside.
Yeah, no.
It's the opposite to a TARDIS, isn't it? It looks enormous from the outside.
Yeah.
But then when you come inside, it just looks very small.
Yeah.
And where we're standing here, looking back at where the congregation would be, on the right-hand side, I can see a wonderful black and white photo.
That's right.
Let's go and have a look.
On the right of that is a long piece of wood looking rather worn and so on. Very obscure as to what it is, but underneath it says it may well have been the post which was over her body in the place where she was shot in
Brussels.
Yeah.
So the original grave marker, effectively.
We think so.
Where
we
she's
think
died.
So, but we can't be absolutely sure.
No.
Some of the things on the post suggest that there may have been a photo which says this is where this was and this is what this was. So it's quite...
So is it upside down?
Poignant, really.
Again, that's a fantastic photograph of her, isn't it? She's got such a clear complexion. Her eyes are looking back. You say she's probably about 30 in that photograph.
Yeah.
But she's very distinctive, isn't she? And, you know, how would you describe her character, do you think?
Well, some said she was rather serious, which she was, because, you know, she rose up the ranks, and as a matron, you couldn't be much other than serious.
Mm.
But they said when she smiled, you never forgot it.
Mm, a radiant smile, perhaps.
Absolutely.
And she really had got heart of gold, didn't she? To put she must have known what she was doing was very dangerous.
Well, she did. I mean, she made the decision. The first really crunchy decision was she was on holiday in July, and they said war is about to break out. If you don't get back, you won't get back. And she had to make that decision that night as to what she'd do. And she said, "No, I must go back. My duty is with my nurses." And that is her all over.
Yeah.
My duty is with my nurses. You know, we started nursing in 1907 in this place, and that is my job, my calling, what God has given me to do. So
that's her faith calling and her sense of duty, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not one or the other, it's both.
No, it's all bound up together inside the woman.
Mm.
She was only 5'3".
Really?
So she's quite a little bundle of energy.
Yeah.
And everybody was a bit shorter in those days.
Of course they were, generally. Yeah.
But she was quite a...
And did she ever get married?
No. There was a cousin, Eddie, who was interested, but he had some sort of problem health-wise, and he said, I can't marry. And I think she said, I am... in a sense, married to nursing, this is my calling, and that's what I'm going to do.
Mm.
One other sister didn't marry. The third sister was married to a surgeon. Both of them have been nurses as well.
Yeah.
So how about all three?
Yeah, so it runs in the family.
Yeah.
The siblings.
Yeah.
And they all outlived her.
They did.
Yeah.
They did, absolutely. Yeah.
It feels, it's a cold day today, we're just before Christmas, but it feels like she's still here to me.
Oh, that's nice. Yes.
Especially when I now look at, first of all, when we looked at the window, but then when I turned around and saw a photograph like that, I've seen lots of images and photographs, but to see one in the church where I know that she spent a lot of time,
she did.
To see a look in her face there, it does feel as though she's here.
You got the message exactly, my brother. Very
good. Do you get a lot of visitors coming there?
Yeah, quite a lot. Yeah, the visitors book regularly records we came to see, and we didn't know that much about Edith. And
a lot of this is on the website. Is it you that's on right. the website then? Ah, fantastic.
And that will become part of the holding of the library of the cathedral.
Yes.
Because we've got enormous numbers of books and papers and all sorts of archive material now about her. And this stuff on the end here is an attempt to say, let's look at it pictorially and understand something of what she was doing.
It's a good way of doing it, isn't it?
That piano is the piano that she played. That is music that she played on it. We know it's hers because we've got the details of the auction. When they left the house, they couldn't take the piano with them.
So that's from their home?
That's right.
And where is that now, then?
It's in the school she may have attended some time in
Norwich. Oh, right.
It's not playable, but an old builder rang me up from North Norfolk saying, are you the cavalman? I said, I suppose you could call me that. I've got this here piano sitting in the garage, and unless you want it, it's going on the tip.
Oh.
And I said,
there's only one answer to that, isn't
there? Absolutely. They say that people who lived here, who's now dead, they say it was her piano. So I said, well, let me come and see it. Let's have a look at some of the history. So we found the history, and there we were. And these are things that you feel in. And at the school, when they received the piano, we had a concert. And the music mistress, who's a very experienced musician, who I know well, she said the stuff she was playing is well beyond grade 8.
Really?
You know, really seriously complicated stuff. Now, I learned the other day that Edith has a criminal record.
No.
Yes.
This is news.
Yes, absolutely.
This is news.
In Brussels.
Right.
The postman had to report that he had been assaulted by the dog and his trousers had been torn.
Right.
How about that?
So really then, in theory, it's the dog. It's got a criminal record.
That's
not
right. No, but it's the owner. Dog out of control. Should be shot or something. Anyway, so
I've been there.
Fun.
I've been to, Edith Cavell in the Rockies in Canada.
The first memorial to her in the world. 1916, the Canadian
June
government said.
Jasper, that was it. That's Jasper it. National yeah. Park. Yeah, I remember going there. Yeah. Didn't go up it.
Just saw it. You've done better than me. So, there's some interesting stuff. This is a rose. There was a rose grower in the village, an internationally famous rose grower called Peter Beals, who actually, their place is now down in Attleborough. And he picked up a rose that somebody had named after her in 1918, and he started propagating it, and we have it in the church, and we have it in my garden.
We'll come back in the summer, and we get to see
The rose. There's the biggest memorial to her, other than the mountain. This is in St. Martin's. St. Martin's in London.
Oh, in London, of course it is,
by
yes.
By the National Portrait Gallery.
Yep.
And that whole thing is 40 feet high.
Yeah.
And she's standing in front of it, looking very serious.
Very.
But the other one, you're quite right. She was buried outside Norwich Cathedral in 1919 at the family's request, because they had offered her a burial space in
Westminster
Abbey. Yeah, right.
She wants to come home.
Yeah,
family wants her to come home.
That's right. Again, done by a Norwich, both these statues, massive statues, and big bits of work, done by the man, the professional sculptors who wanted to make a contribution in her memory, and so no charge.
Really? They've done that out of love and respect.
Love and respect, exactly. Yeah.
For someone that they clearly did respect so much.
And if you happen to be a cigar smoker, you could have
cigar brands
for her, and safety matches for her, and so on and so forth. This is arrant propaganda.
Yes.
Pictures of
but it worked.
Death and, all the pictures of the figure of death.
Yeah.
And her nursing as a German soldier and standing in front of German justice and being shot by the Germans and being offered by the Germans to It's a bit horrible, really.
It does.
And that's the very, very last letter that she ever wrote to her mother, which was dated 26th of July 1915, and she was arrested on August the 5th.
So she didn't actually get to write a letter.
Well, she wrote that one, but she didn't get any more out of Belgium. So that came to the library from Canada. Again, nice Canadian link, and that's the what she says.
There is a big connection with Canada, isn't there?
Yeah.
I've got a copy of that letter in front of me, and this is what Edith said to her mum. "My darling mother, just a few lines to tell you how glad I was to see your letter of June 24th and to know that you were well and all the family. After so long a silence, there are fewer and fewer opportunities of sending here. You may have assumed that. All goes on as usual and that we are very well. Gracie is better again, but I fear not permanently. Will you let her father know I've received the money he sent? It was handed over to me by the German bank. He will probably send him a receipt signed by me. About my pension fund, will you pay it from now to December from the £25 you have to hand and take your money as well? The pension falls due in January, I think. Will you ask them to pay it direct to you quarterly if they can and use it yourself? I enclose a word for the secretary, Mr. Dick. We are without news and very quiet, and I can tell you nothing. After, when I return there, there will be much to relate. We move into a new school at the end of this week or the beginning of next. It advances rapidly now, and the nurses are nearly all there already. The patients will move there at the last. The little garden in front is gay with flowers and cleaning in progress. It is very dirty, as you may imagine, and I will want going over many times before it is really nice, as the workmen are still in and are not likely to finish for some time yet. We have had much rain. I often think of W. Runton and of how much we should have regretted such a wet July. Will you please reply to the address which will be enclosed with this letter? I shall get your answer, surely, though probably with some delay. We have more patients just now and are glad we shall not have to move them far. When I can get a good photo of the new place, I will try and send it to you. Jackie is well and sends a lick. He gets old and is not quite so frisky as he used to be. There are no longer any motor cars to run after, but he lays outside and keeps his street in order and is overjoyed at a walk. My dearest love to you and all the family. I'm looking forward to a happy meeting later on. Ever your affectionate daughter, Edith." Jackie, she talked about there, was, as I'm sure you'll have guessed, her pet dog.
And all the stuff about this is, for anybody listening who wants to know more, www.edithcavill.org.uk.
That's a wonderful resource.
And if you want to ask questions, then put an inquiry into that and
you'll reply to
it. She had this enormous pull power after her death.
And still has.
In the old British Empire, but also in Europe. French, I mean, she had a... This is interesting to your listeners who are war-orientated. Hitler visited Paris on one day in June 1940 after the capitulation.
Yeah.
He drove round. He saw two statues that really got up his nose. One was a First World War big French general, and the other was to Edith Cavell. He said, "I want that down by the end of the day."
He was upset by a statue of Edith.
Absolutely.
Good. And it went. And it's
it
probably
go?
Not
did
been
it
replaced.
Go? Just home, it's no longer there.
I wonder why, he felt.
Well,
because of,
absolutely.
Because of the power that she had
story.
In her death
absolutely.
Over the First World War, the success of the First World War, which of course he blamed for the demise of Germany after the war.
And the place of women in the war.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Because
yeah.
We think as males of war being our territory.
Mm, up to that point.
Women, you know, like Edith, working in the underground, as it were, trying to get soldiers away, and then turning into spies.
It doesn't fit its narrative, really, does it?
No,
it's what we know of it.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So, standing in the December drizzle outside the cathedral, in the drizzly rain, it's getting dark. Impressive entrance to the cathedral.
And as you enter it, you see the bust of Edith on top of a stone plinth rising 15 feet maybe. On the bottom of it, the base, it says Edith Cavell, nurse, patriot and martyr. There's a single wooden cross, a small wooden cross that you see placed on the graves in the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries with a poppy on, that someone has placed between the feet of a British Tommy. A splendid figure of a British Tommy in full uniform with his peach cap on, his Lee Enfield rifle on his left hand behind him, and with his right arm is reaching up towards Edith. And there are two, they're made of concrete, but they're supposed to be laurel wreaths, and he's holding one up to her. And I would think, I don't know, but I would think that the sculpture, the architect, that was his way of the British Tommy thanking Edith for the work that she did in 1914 and 1915. And the architect, Henry Pegram, who we heard from earlier, did this work for nothing. These details are inscribed on the side of the memorial with the date of 1918. Which of course is ironic, that means if that statue's been there since 1918, it arrived here before she did. Her funeral took place in Westminster Abbey in 1919. So when the memorial was placed here on this ancient thoroughfare called Tombland here in Norwich, a very old part of the city, she wasn't actually here. Over my right shoulder is an old pub standing on the corner next to a second-hand bookshop, and that pub is called the Edith Cavell. There's an information board here as well, several photographs, four of the soldiers that she helped. Sergeant Fred Meachin, Private Billy Mapes, Sergeant Jesse Tunmore, and Colonel Dudley Boger. The information board tells us that Edith was the first of four children of the Vicar of Swarsden. She worked as a governess in the east of England in Brussels. Aged 30, she returned to care for a sick father, and then enrolled as a trainee nurse, wanting to do, in her words, something useful for people. After nursing for 10 years in the poorest parts of London and Manchester, in 1907, so 7 years, a long time, before the Great War, before the Germans arrived, she moved to Brussels to create the first Belgian professional nurse training school. So in 9 months, Edith took in over 200 soldiers. Eventually, she and her network were betrayed. 35 of them were arrested, interrogated and tried by a German military court. And she and her colleague were shot at dawn on the 12th of October 1915. Her high standards of courage and her love for those in need, even at risk of her own life, grew out of her strong Christian faith. And on the 15th of May 1919, she was buried at the east end of Norwich Cathedral, after a national memorial service in Westminster Abbey. And then it's the information board tells us that in her cell on the night before her execution, her friend, Reverend Stirling Gayham, said to Edith, "We shall always remember you as a heroine and a martyr." But Edith replied, she said, "Don't think of me like that. Think of me only as a nurse who tried to do her duty." And then she went on to say, "Standing as I do in view of God and eternity, I realise that patriotism is not enough. I must have no hatred or bitterness towards anybody." The statue was created by Henry Pegram. It was funded by public subscription, and it was unveiled by Queen Alexandra on the 12th of October 1918. So 3 years to the day since she died. There were huge numbers that attended the unveiling of the memorial, and her memory lives on because very soon after she died, 1917, 1918, before the end of the war, there were six
rest homes for nurses opened in Edith Cavell's name. They were all funded by public subscription. The sixth one was opened in October 1918 in premises now occupied by the Maid's Head Hotel, which is just across the street on the corner, within sight of the memorial. I'm looking at that red brick building now. That was opened as one of those rest homes for retired nurses. So as we enter the grounds of the cathedral to go and see Edith's final resting place, I'm aware that she's all around us. We've come from her home, that small village of Swarston. And even as I stand here now, bottom of Tombland's, behind me on the right is the pub named after her, and to my left is that hotel. And in front of me is the bus, the bronze memorial, the lady herself staring defiantly across the road, there to be remembered by everybody that visits this famous place.
So I'm standing now at Edith Cavell's headstone, a final resting place at Norwich Cathedral. If you stand back and look at the headstone, you could be forgiven for thinking that you were looking at the Portland headstone of a soldier from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, from one of the Commonwealth countries. And I think that was the idea when they put this new headstone here 10 years ago now. She can't, of course, be regarded as an official casualty from the British Army, but to us, she is. It simply says on her Portland headstone, Edith Cavell, 1865 to 1915. And the only other reference to Edith here is on the wall of the cathedral. There's a brass plaque, and it said Edith Cavell was born at Cavell House in Swarston, Norwich, on December 4th, 1865. As matron of a hospital in Brussels, she tended with great devotion the wounded of enemy and allied soldiers alike. For helping many of our men to escape, she was sentenced to death and was shot on October the 12th, 1915. And then those words are repeated again, that she said, "Standing as I do in view of God and eternity, I realise that patriotism is not enough. I must have no hatred or bitterness towards anyone." In the circumstances, it's a splendid epitaph of a most extraordinary woman that so many people owe so much to. This woman's story is known throughout the world, and in particular Canada and, of course, in Belgium. In France, that memorial that Hitler had removed is no longer there, but her spirit is still there. Her spirit is everywhere. It's amongst us, and I feel extremely privileged to follow her journey here today and to stand here knowing that she's beneath my feet in a place that she called home, near to the God that she worshipped so much. She followed her faith to do what she called her duty. It's now over 110 years since she died. But of course, Edith will never, ever be forgotten.
One day, I shall go to Brussels and find the place where Edith was imprisoned and executed and buried for 4 years before she returned to the UK. That's for the future. But for now, by listening to this today, we remember Edith and everything that she did. Her incredible life. I'm very grateful to a man called Canon Philip McFadden. He was the rector of the Swarston Church in the early 1990s, and he wrote a pamphlet which I've used for much of the information about Edith today. She said, "Don't think of me as a heroine and a martyr. Think of me only as a nurse who tried to do her duty." Her duty she did, of course, we know that. Duty was so important to her, and as I've said many times in the last hour, so was her faith. And I think more than ever it's appropriate that in recognition of Edith's life and death, we remember her by the sounding of the last post.